Welcome back to another edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. My name is Ben Golliver. I'm from BlazersEdge.com. I'm here with Kevin Pelton from BasketballPerspectives.com and also Basketball Perspectives, the book, the annual guide to the NBA that every NBA fan needs to own. And that's why I'm going to extort you for a copy the next time I see you. KP2, what is up? It's been a long offseason with no podcast. Congratulations on the Seattle Storm's WNBA championship. How are you doing, and are you ready to talk some NBA?
First off, thank you. Second off, this feels like it's the first day of school. We've been gone all summer long, and we kind of need to catch up on what's been going on, see what everybody's been doing, who got rid of their glasses and became much better looking, all those sorts of things. So it's a very exciting day. And, yeah, I'm ready to talk some NBA. I'm about ready to finish this book, which has been driving me insane for the last week or so. And if Billy King or Masai Ujiri or any of the general managers, Kevin O'Connor, Michael Jordan, if they happen to be listening to the Wingcast, I know we have many general manager listeners, please do not make this trade before the book comes out. Please just let me get it done without having to rewrite four chapters. Thank you. That's my personal plea.
Hey, two things real quick. Were you just trying to break some news, like you just went through puberty or something? You wanted to let everybody know that? Was that what you were talking about earlier? What was going on with that? And second, would it really be that big of a deal in the scope of the NBA if a guy like Carmelo Anthony was traded before the season started? I mean, would that really impact what you have written, you know, what you've poured hundreds of hours and hundreds of pages into? It doesn't seem like it would really be that big of a deal, would it?
Well, it's not really about Carmelo getting traded. It's more about Quentin Ross changing teams and how that would affect the Shaney projections and everything like that. It's for the first, it was just, a fairly lame attempt at humor. I was thinking about the high school
experience.
We're
going to wait until next year on that one then?
Yeah. I was thinking about the high school experience. A couple weeks ago, I had my 10-year high school reunion, so that was really exciting.
Were you the most famous person that attended?
Yeah, I would say it was the most famous person that attended. It's a draw as to, well, it's not a draw, but there's a competition for who's the most famous person from our class, because we have a professional female soccer player in the WPS who could not make it because she was busy with her team, which is the best team in the league.
Well, so you're still saying you're still, that's a good sign. You're showing that you're still humble enough not to consider yourself more famous than a professional athlete. I think we should mark that down, because I have a feeling in 2 years you're going to be like, who? You're going to pretend like you never heard of her. You didn't even know if she's playing, you know. That's good, KB. That's a good humble check. I'm glad that we did that. So, you know, what's going to get you to that next step where you're going to start pretending that you don't know who I am, not returning my phone calls, is obviously this book that you're trying to hawk right now. Tell us about the book this season real quick. What's new? What's the same? And obviously, you know, you can maybe let people know which team you have jumped on their bandwagon. I think most of our listeners by this point are already going to know which team that is, but you can go ahead and feel free to drop that knowledge bomb on us.
Yeah, I think it's fairly similar to the debut effort. The same kind of great hard-hitting analysis essays on each team, individual capsules on each player for people who haven't read last year's Pro Basketball Prospectus. We've got 3 years' worth of advanced statistics as well as Shaney's projections for the upcoming season. We've got some other goodies as far as, there's a fantasy section this year. I took over the fantasy discussion, which is kind of funny because I'm not very good myself at playing fantasy, but hopefully this year will be better and my picks will work out well for everyone. And then also we've got some other essays in there. I took a look at which is the best league in the world outside the NBA, things like that. So all sorts of fun, 340-some-odd pages, just chock full of numbers and analysis and even the occasional joke.
And which team's bandwagon have you decided to jump on? Can we go ahead and do some breaking news like do-do-do-do?
The Portland Trail Blazers.
Portland Trail Blazers, ladies and gentlemen, against all odds. You never would have thought that the guy who does a podcast on a Portland Trail Blazers site would pick the Portland Trail Blazers to be the breakout team of the season, but that's what you've done, haven't you?
Look, I definitely don't put my finger on the scale for things like that. It's only to try to keep the Warriors' projection from being too good, and that's not a joke. when you look at what Cheney considers and the way that we project things in terms of health and player development and things like that, the Blazers simply look like potentially an elite team in the 2010-11 season. And I think, you know, we the people who are listening to this podcast are certainly familiar with the kind of injuries that Portland went through last season. I think even around the league, everyone has a general sense of it. They probably saw the injury report on a TNT game and laughed at it. Or even Nate McMillan got hurt or something like that. And obviously that's a big part of the essay, is kind of running through all of the injuries that the Blazers faced last year. But then when it comes to projecting ahead to next year, people don't realize, well, you know, the Blazers may have injuries this season. I don't think you can count at this point on Greg Oden being fully healthy. Certainly, you know, the 60 to 65 game target that Chad Buchanan threw out the other day seems like a reasonable one. But there's no way the Blazers are going to be as injured as they were last year. When you look at having Marcus Camby on the roster for a full season and what that's going to do for the Blazers defensively, as opposed to having used Juwan Howard in the middle, there's the potential for this to be one of the best teams in the league.
Wow. So when you're talking about win projections and or even placement projections, I mean, are you ready to say, do you want to put a number on it? I mean, are the Blazers going to be your favorites for the Northwest Division? I mean, how high are you on these Blazers? Let's say, you know, the Blazers, you bottle them up and put them in an aerosol can, and you shoot it up your nose, you know, exactly how high are you on, you know, what level is that, are the Blazers taking you to?
Well, that might be the worst analogy I've ever heard. We have the Blazers projected for 55 wins, which may not sound like a lot on paper. You know, it's only a few more than they won last year. But when you consider that the nature of projections is generally conservative by its nature, that's a pretty big-time projection. And it's not only tops in the Northwest Division, but tops in the Western Conference and second in the entire league behind the Miami Heat.
Oh, man. I think you just caused a tidal wave through Oregon of excitement. I love to hear that, KP. So here's my question for you, and break this down for me, because I know your projection system is not the only one that's high on the Blazers, right? You've got a lot of people, when they look at the numbers or the statistical projection people, you know, they seem to be much higher on the Blazers than maybe your shoot from the hip analyst might be. So, you know, when I'm reading a lot of these preview magazines, even people who know a lot about the NBA, people whose opinion I really trust, you know, I look at them and they're saying Blazers are probably, you know, potentially third or fourth in the Northwest Division. You know, Blazers are going to be right around, you know, 50 or upper 40s for wins. There seems to be a big chasm between, you know, what some of the experts who aren't using maybe statistical projections are expecting from the Blazers, and then what, you know, people who are using statistical projections are expecting from the Blazers. Because I've seen up to, what, 60 wins on some projection systems for the Blazers, and I don't think necessarily that you're alone in thinking that they're going to be right at the top of the Western Conference. Why is there such a big difference of opinion between the people who are looking at the numbers and the people who aren't? I mean, is that a function of last year's injuries, or are there other contributing factors? Age of Brandon Roy and LaMarcus Aldridge, I mean, why else, you know, why else would there be such a difference of opinion when you use the numbers compared to when you don't?
Well, when you're looking at it from a subjective standpoint, I think a lot of times people look at storylines, and the storylines at the Blazers aren't necessarily positive. You look at the offseason, Kevin Pritchard getting fired, and the chaos that kind of ensued from that. The Blazers didn't make a big splash over the offseason. Their marquee addition was Wesley Matthews, you know, an undrafted second-year shooting guard who isn't going to start. The biggest talk the last couple months has been about Greg Oden's health and whether Rudy Fernandez is going to get traded. It's understandable why nationally people wouldn't see a lot of reasons to be positive about the Blazers. But when you kind of strip out that subjective layer, you know, and with the injuries, I go back to a Malcolm Gladwell anecdote that I think I've referenced a few times on Basketball Prospectus. He talks about it in, I believe it's The Tipping Point, a study done by a psychologist looking to analyze perception. So they sent a player to shoot baskets in two gyms, one of which was well lit and one of which the lights were turned off and he couldn't see very well. Well, obviously the player shot better in the situation where the lights were on and he could see the rim very well and things like that. We understand, you know, on some level that the reason that he shot worse in the poorly lit gym was because of an outside factor beyond his control, not his own ability. Yet still, when these psychologists asked the participants in the study to rate the shooter at the two different gyms, they rated him as a worse shooter when he was shooting in the more poorly lit gym. They took the outside external factor and kind of internalized it. So we like to think that teams and players and individuals have more control over the outcome of their efforts than really sometimes they truly do. So in a case of something like injuries, I think we can, you know, there's an understanding that it affects them. It's part of the story. But in terms of kind of analyzing the importance of that and what it actually means going forward, it tends to get underrated. So I think you see that with a couple teams this year, both in the Northwest Division, both of whom have been closely linked. On the one hand, you have the Blazers, who are battered by injuries, and on the other, you have Oklahoma City, that is one of these kind of trendy it teams going into next season, that dealt with almost no injuries last year and is likely going to have to battle some worse luck on the health front this upcoming season.
You know, when I look at the Blazers and some of the expectations and things that you're talking about, you know, I kind of see all three of the Blazers, you know, key players contributing to, you know, some of the negative storylines or maybe some of the reasons why people are emotionally overlooking the Blazers. I look at Greg Oden and you start to think, you know, how many times have people even seen this guy play? How many people were even able to see him play last year? If you're talking about the experts, I mean, given that he only played such a small number of games, you know, an even smaller number of those games were on national television, you know, people have forgotten who Greg Oden is, forgotten who, you know, what Greg's capable of. And, you know, they kind of dismiss all of his permanent stats and they think, hey, you know, he hasn't done it in a, you know, sample size, basically. He hasn't proven that he can do it over the course of an entire season. And I think that's, you know, probably a fair criticism, but still it's an easy way for them to dismiss him. I look at Brandon Roy, and, you know, he was not really a major participant in that playoff series, and so people start to question, you know, is he going to be able to hold up? And when it comes playoff time, is he going to be there and able to deliver? And people kind of forget how clutch he has been or he's proven to be at different points in his career, and so I think people are a little bit low on him. And also, I think you look at LaMarcus Aldridge, and I think, let's say Aldridge plays on Team USA this summer and he goes and does what a guy like Lamar Odom did or even doesn't even play as well as that. It's just, you know, getting some run or some positive publicity and staying, instead of staying completely off the radar like he did, you know, I think maybe, you know, people would be able to latch onto that as a potential storyline. But I think right now what people are thinking is, okay, Brandon is going to try to get back to that level he was at previously rather than, you know, Brandon's poised to have the best season of his life. Guy like LaMarcus Aldridge hasn't shown, you know, the ability to go above and beyond like we had hoped he would, so he's going to be the same 18-8 guy he's always been. And Greg Oden, he's going to be the same injured player that we always expect. So I think you can see all three of those guys contributing to this, you know, this tendency to overlook the Blazers. And I would expect all three of those guys to kind of come into camp with a chip on each of their shoulders, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. You know, Roy is kind of maybe the most interesting case because of the fact that everything was so positive for him in the 2007 or the 2008-9 season. He was this rising young star. And then last year, he didn't play substantially worse. You know, he wasn't quite at the same level, but he had the hamstring injury over the course of the year, and then he had the knee injury in the playoffs. And all of a sudden, you see him kind of being off the map. I think the fact that he isn't part of the USA basketball program has had that same kind of influence. And then his only off-season kind of storyline was the rap video and that wildly overplayed cameo of about 15 seconds. You know, got Portland talking for a week. So there's just been kind of a lot of negativity around the Blazers and some of their key players this summer that obscures the good things that are going on.
So why weren't you in that video? I mean, I know you were posted up in that gymnasium watching those guys at that summer league or whatever they run out there. How come we didn't get a Kevin Pelton or KP2, you know, what they want cameo? Where were you?
Well, I wish I had been, but that falls under the line I'm stealing from Bethlehem Shoals, which is I'm too busy writing about basketball to ever watch basketball. So I didn't make it out.
Yeah, I know how that goes. So here's a question that I keep getting, and I'm going to ask you. Let's say the Blazers – let's just default to the idea the Blazers win the Northwest Division, right? Let's say, you know, all the statistical projections work out. The Blazers have their best players in their prime. Everybody shows up. Everybody stays relatively healthy. Oden eventually comes around. He provides the double-double everybody's been expecting. Blazers are able to carry that Northwest Division crown. Which team, as of right now, is going to give them the biggest run within the division? Is it going to be Utah with, you know, Jefferson reloaded team there? Is it going to be the Oklahoma City Thunder, who we've talked about a little bit, with Kevin Durant looking like either the first or second best player in the NBA? Or is it going to be Denver, who may try to hold it together here with Carmelo Anthony, or may just say, screw it, forget it, and trade him? I mean, which one of those three teams do you think is going to provide the serious rivalry, the serious matchup that, you know, it's going to define the storylines of the Northwest Division this season?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer as we sit here on, what is this, September 24th? Just because we don't know about Carmelo Anthony's future. And I think if the Nuggets are able to hold on to him, I think they are one of the most underrated teams in the Western Conference. When you look at outside factors affecting the perception of the way the team played, well, you know, the Nuggets can go toe-to-toe with the Blazers in terms of they lost their coach to a battle with cancer. It was obviously, you know, horrifying on a personal level, but on a basketball level, the Nuggets were a substantially worse team with Adrian Dantley coaching them on an interim basis than they were with George Karl. You know, they were arguably the second-best team in the Western Conference before Karl left the bench. They'd been the second-best team in the Western Conference the year before, reaching the conference finals. And why no one thinks that if they are able to keep Anthony that they're going to contend in the West this year is just kind of beyond me. I mean, they've got some injuries in the front court with Kenyon Martin and Chris Anderson coming off of off-season knee surgeries, but they've added some depth there with Al Harrington. I think Sheldon Williams, as much of a punchline as he is somebody who's at least going to be an upgrade on Malik Allen and Johan Petro and the kind of stiffs they were throwing out when Martin got injured last season. So I think the Nuggets have a chance to be pretty good. So Carmelo, if you're listening, again, this is my plea. Give this a shot.
Well, here's my one problem with the Nuggets. Correct me if I'm wrong, and actually I'd like to know what Shaney has to say. But I think Chauncey Billups is done, man. I think he's done.
Really? I'm surprised by that. You know, Shaney is pretty positive. When you look at Billups' comparables, they're guys who generally aged pretty well because of the fact that they had the three-point ability to fall back on. They had good size on the perimeter that helped them, you know, overcome the fact that they lost a half step or something because of their quickness. But it's interesting, the Nuggets blogger from Roundball Mining Company, Jeremy Wagner, I believe, sounded a much less positive note in his section of the book. But even if Billups is done, they've got Ty Lawson sitting there who is just a premier backup and I think is perfectly capable of stepping in if Billups goes down for an extended period.
Oh, we know you're the biggest Ty Lawson fan in the universe, so we don't need to go down that route. The only reason I say that about Billups is, you know, I was watching his world championship, and it's tough because, you know, he's one of the older guys. And, you know, whenever you get into the summer where they also had a long playoff stretch, I mean, you wonder, I mean, how much gas in the tank does this guy have, you know, when he's playing in the world championships, even though they're playing for a gold medal and whatnot. But, you know, his jumper did not look as I get used to, you know, just a little bit more cringeworthy. I didn't think his decision-making and his timing was as good as it used to be. Maybe it was just, you know, dealing with a different offensive system or dealing with, you know, weirder zone looks that he was getting in the World Championships. It just – he didn't seem like the best point guard by a long shot on that team. And, you know, maybe he provided some leadership stuff that he obviously can still provide in Denver as well. But he just didn't seem like everything was clicking as smoothly as it used to for him. And it just seemed like, well, maybe that's because of the aging. I couldn't think of another explanation. What did you think when you watched him in the World Championships?
Well, the other thing is also he was playing a different position a lot off the ball because he's going alongside Derrick Rose in that undersized USA backcourt. So, no, it wasn't something that really worried me. I wouldn't say I was particularly impressed with how he played, and I was kind of surprised he played as much as he did. I think probably only the leadership factor. But I don't know that worries me a lot.
It didn't really matter who they threw out there as long as they had Durant, did it?
Yeah, and that's the X factor with Oklahoma City. And we talked about their health, but anytime you have a guy who has a legitimate chance to win MVP, and I don't know if he's got a chance to surpass LeBron James as the best player in the league statistically, but he's comes into the season and is probably the favorite to be number two. So anytime you have that kind of player on the roster and the young talent Oklahoma City has, they've certainly got a chance to be scary.
I think Kevin Durant's better than LeBron James right now.
Is this part of baiting me? Is the LeBron defender, LeBron stopper?
The LeBron stopper. Well, no, I'm not really trying to bait you so much as just, I mean, put it out there. Like, this guy is a smarter player. You know, he's more efficient, right?
He's a slightly more efficient scorer.
He doesn't make as many turnovers, right?
No.
So, I mean, what more do you want from him? I mean, I think he showed a new level of commitment on defense, and maybe he's not as good of a defender. He's definitely not as versatile of a defender, but I don't think he's, you know, a liability like he maybe was in his first year or two. I think he's more competitive. I think he's a smarter player. I think he understands the moment far better. I mean, I think that he intuitively understands the moment better than LeBron James ever will. And I understand that's probably like shooting from the hip to you stat nerd guys. You know, there's no such thing as the moment, and certainly no one could understand a moment, and we shouldn't even discuss it. But I think that we saw during the World Championship an understanding of here's when it's takeover time. It almost seemed Jordan-esque to me. Am I going too far?
I don't know. I think LeBron showed a pretty good sense of the moment in the 2008 Olympics, and had he been in a situation like Durant where he was – clearly the star on the roster, it might have been a little bit different than him sharing top billing with Kobe Bryant and Dwayne Wade. But
my understanding of LeBron understanding the moment was just get out of the way and let Kobe handle it.
He made some pretty big plays in 2008.
He obviously understood the moment pretty well in the Eastern Conference Finals when he was untucking his shirt and walking off the court because Delonte West was
okay, now we are back to where the bus wasn't made.
I'm just kidding. Anyway, okay, we don't need to get into this LeBron versus Kevin Durant debate. I agree, LeBron's great. I was just kind of trying to tweak you a little bit. But I understand, you know, in terms of the fantasy stuff, which you say that, you know, you do have in the book this year that you wrote. I mean, it's KD and everybody else, right?
Actually, Chris Paul comes out numerically as the number one guy, but I think that KD's projection is a little low because it still takes into account his season of PJ Carlissimo, which I think we can safely write off by this point as an aberration. So one of the things I did write was last year I had the number one overall pick in my fantasy league, and I took Chris Paul, which didn't work out when he went down with knee surgery. If I had the number one pick this year, even though the numbers say barely Chris Paul, I would go with Durant.
I think I'm going to name my fantasy team, which I don't have because I've explained before I don't play fantasy. But if I did, I'd name it Boris Diaw Breast Reduction after what's about to happen if he gets traded to the Utah Jazz. What do you think about that name?
I'm surprised it isn't Denard Robinson for Heisman.
Oh, well. Yeah, that's probably already taken in all the Yahoo leagues. So let's get back on track here about the Blazers. One of the major storylines I see developing is which rookie – of the three, if it's Babbitt, if it's Johnson, or if it's Williams, if any of them is going to be able to crack the rotation. I mean, I think, you know, we've got the starting lineup set. Everybody understands who's going to be the starters. Not a real ton of questions about that. Obviously, there's a question about Oden. When does he come back into the starting lineup? I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. In fact, if I had to wager on it, I would guess that we don't see Oden starting an NBA game until probably Thanksgiving. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Playing an NBA game or starting an NBA game?
Starting an NBA game. I don't think he's going to be starting an NBA game until Thanksgiving.
That's fair.
Because, you know, they pretty much already are letting us know he's not going to be ready for opening night. I mean, more or less they're saying that, right? Well, if you're not ready for opening night, you know, you're starting to talk about, okay, you got to ramp him up for a couple of weeks before you're going to throw him in the starting lineup, especially because, you know, you've got a lot of these games where you really got to win right off the bat. So, you know, you're trying to get some good momentum entering the season. Brandon Roy's all raring to go. I mean, you don't want to throw any weird variables at him, right? So I think that, you know, they're going to bring him along slowly, working him back into the starting lineup. Now, I do obviously think that Odin's going to be your starting center as soon as he's ready. I just think that's going to be a slow process, and we're looking at like a Thanksgiving timeline for that. So other than that, though, all the other spots are locked up. So the question sort of becomes, okay, who's fighting for those rotation minutes? I think we can pencil Wesley Matthews in, no question about it. I think he's going to be part of it. I think you can pencil Jared Bayless in, no question about it. Front court guys, I think there's, you know, some more questions about who's going to be ready to step up. Some of it depends on health. I think Pris Bill is going to take a while to get back, so, you know, he's probably not going to be, you know, mentioned. You know, you're probably going to use a guy like Pendergraft before Oden's ready, so he'll probably get some time. But when we look at the rookies, Babbitt, Johnson, and Williams, do you see or did you project when you were looking through the rotation, did you see any of those guys getting playing time? And if so, who and why?
I had Babbitt getting the most playing time. I think that over the course of the season, you're going to find a spot for him. That was actually partially because, you know, you didn't know where to project Rudy Fernandez, and I think they actually need to go in and pump up his minutes projection now that it looks like he will be coming to camp and being a part of the team, at least for some period of time. But Babbitt provides a skill that you don't have anywhere else on the roster in terms of size on the wing behind Nicholas Batum. You know, your backup wing players right now are primarily Fernandez and Wesley Matthews, who are more two guards than small forwards. So Babbitt is a little bit of a complement to them. That logjam, to me, Elliot Williams has the least chance of the three guys of getting any minutes this season. He's more of a long-term play. And then Johnson is interesting because I do think he's got a chance to unseat Jared Bayless as the backup point guard just because he's such a better fit for what the Blazers need and much more of a true point guard. So I think that he might be the least ready in some ways to contribute of the three guys, but also might have the best chance of playing regular night-in, night-out minutes.
Do you think they could find a situation where they're using Johnson and Bayless together in that second unit? I mean, do you see that being a combination that might work?
I don't think you'd have a reason to do it this year in terms of you've got so much, you know, unless you've got injuries that are putting Wesley Matthews in the starting lineup or something like that, you've got enough depth on the perimeter that you wouldn't want to have both of those guys playing. But I think in terms of a combination of players that could work, yeah, I mean, I think I like Jared Bayless playing off the ball. You're a little light on shooting with that duo.
Yeah, you are, and I think that, you know, that comes into how you would work the rotation. So whether you'd have, you know, would you work those guys in with Batum? So, you know, he's helping to space the floor, or would Matthews maybe go, you would go a little bit smaller and you bring Matthews in at the three? Could you get all three of those guys out there together? I mean, that's one combination that I've been interested in just because, you know, I think that they could interchange defensively relatively well. You can both guard, you know, backup guards without too much trouble. I think Bayless, you know, use him in that two-guard role and you just kind of turn him loose and say, get your own shot. He's probably going to be more comfortable. And then you let Armand run the offense a little bit. I think that's a combination that could definitely work. It's one that I was asking them about, you know, even dating back before Summer League, and it was one that, you know, they were saying, you know, hey, yeah, it could work at some point. I think the question really is the timeline. When are those guys going to be ready? And when's Nate going to feel comfortable using them together? And I think that's, you know, definitely an open question heading into training camp. But I think your point about Babbitt, though, is a really good one. Is, you know, of the three players, you know, who's on paper, who's maybe the least ready to go? I think it's probably Babbitt. But at the same time, you know, where's the need or where's the positional opening for some playing time? And I think you've got to say it's for Babbitt at the backup three spot. And that could, you know, end up making Nate just kind of simplify the game for Babbitt and say, hey, we want you to do this on offense and this on defense and don't worry about anything else. And, you know, that might work out for a guy like Babbitt. I mean, he's so competitive and, you know, he's got some defined skills. I think, you know, shooting obviously and, you know, some offensive versatility. I think you might be right to say that he's the guy who's going to have the biggest impact of the three rookies. You know, a guy like Elliot Williams, and you had mentioned him, you know, is he the odd man out when you look at the rotation? I mean, do you think that things could change considerably for him if they say trade Rudy for a draft pick? I mean, do you think he's ready to step up, or do you still see him as being a ways away? I mean, it's hard to know really without having seen him in summer league and you know, having him been in two different environments in college. I mean, he seems like the biggest wild card on the entire roster to me.
Yeah, I mean, statistically, I think he's a little bit behind Babbitt in terms of readiness. And even in that scenario, you've still got Wes Matthews locking down the backup shooting guard. And then the other possibility is, like you mentioned, Bayless sliding over to that position and playing it. So there's a lot of competition for minutes at the two guard without, without Elliot Williams being in the position, without a lot of minutes to go around, I should say, behind Brandon Roy if he's healthy in the lineup. So it's tough to see a scenario where Williams is really playing a lot of minutes this year. I think the lineup that intrigues me more is Williams and Bayless playing together, because Williams is a pretty good ball handler for a two guard, has good size for the position, a little bit better shooter than Armin Johnson, so you're not sacrificing that as much. I think that's the guy who could eventually be the good pair for Bayless.
Interesting. Yeah. So who would you have on the ball?
Probably Bayless.
Bayless, yeah. Yeah, because that's the thing is, you know, and this is something I never wrote, but I probably should have. It's like Williams in his head, he thinks he's a one for whatever reason. He thinks he's an NBA one. He thinks he's running an offense. That's who he thinks he is. And nobody seems to agree with him on that. Like, I don't know if he's just in his own little universe about it. I mean, it's not even like Bayless where, like, everyone was trying to buy in and say, okay, yeah, we're going to try to, like, turn him into a one. We're going to use that one summer league, you know, his second summer league as a kind of an audition to be the point guard and run the offense and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's not like they're saying he can't play one, but nobody really sees that as his natural tendency, and they don't really see the same desire to try to turn Williams into a one like they did with Bayless. I mean, Williams to me seems like, okay, he's a two. That's what he does. He's off the ball, and he can do some things, as Nate would say. And Bayless to me seems like you got to have the ball in his hands. So, you know, if that makes him a one or if that makes him a two where he's, you know, running the pick and roll a lot, you know, that's fine. So I don't know. I mean, are there enough balls to go around for those two guys to play together?
I think the concern would be, will the ball get to the front court if you've got those two guys in the back court? Depending on who you've got playing alongside them, that might not be a big deal. You might want them handling the ball, but yeah, they'll get their shots. Everyone else.
There's going to be a competition for field goal attempts between the two of them. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, hopefully an even battle.
So what does Shaney say about the second year, guys? I know we don't have too much more time here. We'll try to wrap this up real quickly. And, you know, every time we talk about Shaney, that's everyone's, like, Pavlov dog response. Like, that's, like, the bell to go online and purchase Kevin's book. So Shaney, that should, like, cue you in. Go online, buy this book. You get the whole scoop there. What does Shaney project for these second-year guys, these guys like Dante and Jeff? You know, Dave actually wrote a piece on Blazers Edge about what his expectations for them. And I think, you know, in typical Dave fashion, they were relatively muted. I don't think he was expecting a ton from either one of them. To me, you know, we talk about those minutes behind Nick. If Babbitt's not ready, I see those minutes going to Dante. And if you're forced to use Aldridge at five at all, if Oden and Prisbilla aren't back, I think that opens up a lot of minutes at the four potentially, you know, especially, you know, long stretches for that second unit. And to me, Dante still seems more ready to step in and fill those minutes productively than Jeff does. Does Shaney agree or disagree?
Well, the interesting thing about Dante's comparable players by Shaney is that most of them didn't really develop a lot after they came into the league. So if you're hoping that he's going to become a substantially different player than he is right now, that just might not be in the cards. He might have a tough time increasing his usage rate, you know, the style of play that he has established in terms of the pick and pop. Yeah, you can get a little bit more accurate at those mid-range jumpers, but there's sort of an upper bound to that. The easiest way for him perhaps to take a step in his development is increasing his range by a couple of feet and becoming a bit of a three-point shooter. Like, you know, we saw how that changed Channing Frye's game last year, a little bit different type of player, but same kind of result potentially for Cunningham, and that might also help him if he has to play on the three, although it doesn't seem like Portland really wants to play him there is my sense. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I think they like him at four, but I think what Dante does is, you know, he's that combo guy, and we've talked about this before. You know, Dante and Jeff are both sort of these combos where Dante's is probably 4-3 and Jeff's probably, 5-4. You know, when I look at Dante, I see a guy who can credibly guard two positions. You know, there's going to be some mismatch issues against really bigger fours and, you know, some of the, you know, elite threes he's going to probably have some trouble with. But you look at most of the backup guys, I think Dante, you feel relatively comfortable, especially in a team defensive concept, having him out there. I look at Jeff and I see a guy who can't guard either position. I don't think he can guard fives. And I don't think he can guard fours. So I think, you know, when you look at those two guys, you know, for who's going to have a bigger role or more playing time, I think that's what it's going to end up coming down to is, you know, yeah, you know, Dante's probably hit relatively close to what his ceiling is on offense. You know, I don't expect him to have this amazing off the dribble game that, you know, we're expecting from Nicholas Batum to add. I do think that Dante can extend his range, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if that's what he's been working on this summer, because you know how much the Blazers like those corner threes. So I wouldn't be, you know, shocked at all to see him having added those elements or at least improved on those elements. But I think, you know, ultimately defensively, he's relatively good lateral quickness against most threes. He can guard any of the combo fours, and then he's got the body strength, and also the quickness to stay with a lot of fours, you know, traditional fours, if there are such a thing anymore in the NBA. It seems like everybody's combo fours these days. I just feel like he's a mismatch problem on defense against a lot less people than a guy like Jeff is.
Well, you've clearly been reading Pro Basketball Prospectus and learning from it again, because that's exactly what I said in terms of Pendergraph not having the position defensively. You know, the Blazers just gave up a ton of points when he was in the middle, and that's going to be a problem, I think, again this year. His instincts should be a little better, and one thing Sheeney projects is that he'll improve his foul rate, which was fairly high last season. But I don't see him ever being an impact defensive player, and you kind of need that for a guy like that who's a role player on offense.
No doubt. Is there anything else from the Blazers chapter that you want to tease real quick, KP? You know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, the projections for them win-wise, right near the top of the league, you know, in the upper echelon with the Miami Heat. We've talked a little bit about some of the comparables and the players, who how they stack up, and you've obviously got those included for every single Blazer so people can compare their favorite Blazer and say, okay, you know, who is this guy to compare to? You know, you've talked about the minutes element a little bit of how you think the rotation might shake out. What the biggest needs are for the rookies. Is there anything else that stood out to you when you were compiling the Blazers section in terms of this is something that people should watch as we enter the preseason, as we enter the start of the regular season, as, you know, something that might be a little different from the Blazers, you know, compared to the rest of the teams in the league?
Well, let me turn that around on you. Was there one section that particularly stood out to you, one player capsule that I think you might have particularly enjoyed? And I do have a specific answer in mind.
If I had to guess, I'm thinking it's going to be the Nicholas Batum one.
Yeah, we haven't talked about Nick Batum at all right thus far. But Shaney is full of optimism.
Brilliant.
About that guy.
Now, did it factor into the account that I used him for my Twitter icon? Was that one of the adjustments that you made in terms of making his projection? Like, you realize, like, oh, this guy knows so much about basketball. He's picked this player as his Twitter icon. Obviously, we need to give him a bump. Was that considered or no?
It didn't help with Jared Bayless in projecting the 2009-10 season, so I would say no.
Okay, fine. So let's talk about Nicholas Batum. So he's going to be Scottie Pippen.
Yeah.
Basically?
It's not among his comparables, since he was still younger last season than Scottie Pippen was when he came into the league, and probably more effective than Pippen was for a few years, but... When you look at the way he shot the basketball last season, both outside the arc and on two-pointers, he was even maybe better as a two-point shooter. When you look at the way he ramped up his usage rate and has the potential to do that even more this season, other options that Portland has in terms of the physical tools and what he was able to do for the French national team this summer, we know that this guy is capable of getting his own shot at this point. You know, it's just a question of what the Blazers will need from him. And then we haven't even talked about defense. So, suffice it to say that both Shaney and I think I can include you in this too, are all very excited about Nicholas Batum and a full season from him.
Oh, we definitely are. And I got a couple of things about Nick. So, first of all, before I forget, you know, you talk about defensively what Nick can do. You know, we talked last year how he can guard any of the perimeter positions. And even, you know, Nate was talking about using him against some combo fours at times. You know, he's the kind of guy you can use against four different positions, which there's not very many of those guys in the league. But one interesting wrinkle that Nick could provide, and I told you this previously, and I'm going to ask Nate this every single day during training camp to try to, like, you know, subtly work it into his brain, is I think the Blazers should use the closing lineup on the perimeter of Batum, Roy, and Matthews, because I think that gives the Blazers, you know, the best shooting, but also the best combination of shooting and defense. And I'm thinking you would use Batum against the point guard, you'd use Matthews against whoever the best wing was, and you let Brandon just kind of hang out on defense. I think that would give, you know, Brandon the ability to have the ball in his hands, two guys who could space the floor around him, and then also just an incredibly length and solid defense around the perimeter, and just, you know, create mismatch problems for, you know, your average or even slightly above average point guards in dealing with a guy like Nick just hawking them up and down the court. So that's one thing I would love to see Nate do. I'm going to ask him that every single day, hopefully, and plant that brain chip into his head, and we'll see how that works. Now, I haven't had too much success coaching from my laptop up to this point, so don't get your hopes up, but that's one thing I want to mention about Batum. Second thing about Batum, the World Championships play, and you talked about, you know, on offense, you know, he can get his own shot a little bit better than he used to be able to. And, you know, there's a confidence factor. Would you agree? He just seems a little bit – he's got the ball in his hands, and he knows he can do a few more things than he used to be able to do.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
The one thing that stuck out to me, and maybe it's not a negative, but when I was watching him in the World Championships, is that, you know, in the past, you know, a guy like Monty Williams talked about Nick and maybe not bringing that consistent effort, like, you know, the professionals might, because he was so young, you know, there'd be some nights where he wouldn't be all the way in the game, or he wouldn't be all the way ready, impacting the game as well as he could every single night. And that's something that people have to learn, obviously, when they're that young in the NBA. It's something that gets said a lot about young players. When you look at Nick, though, the consistency thing during the World Championships, I did think it popped back up a little bit, and I think there was an inconsistency in his aggressiveness to look for his own shot. It's almost like in certain situations where you wanted him to take over, for whatever reason, on some nights he would, some nights he wouldn't. To me, it's probably more pronounced and more obvious to see that in the World Championship setting when he is sort of that go-to player for them. You know, him and Diao were sort of the go-to offensive players, and they didn't have a great point guard setting things up, making life easy for them. So maybe it won't be as big of a factor here in Portland, but I think if there's a concern for me about Nicholas, it's, does he have the killer instinct that we've seen time and time again from him, but does he bring it every single night? And is he doing that on offense when he is, you know, the third or fourth or fifth option in a given lineup? Because it's tricky to do that. I mean, it's hard to say, oh, I'm going to take my man off the dribble and pull up, or I'm going to take him straight to the rim when you've got guys like Brandon, LaMarcus expecting their touches around you.
Yeah, and I would say that the beauty of having him as the third or fourth or fifth option is you don't need him to do that, because on one night it might be Batum, another night it might be, you know, Odin if he's healthy with a good matchup in the middle. On another night it might be, you know, Andre Miller has got it working, he's getting to the basket. So that's kind of the nature, I think, of that role. And you ride a guy when he does have that good night going, and then the other nights you go to someone else.
No doubt. And sorry to rain on this parade. I understand that, you know, this is your breakout podcast where you become the number one Blazers fan in the entire world, and the number one hype man for the 2010-2011 Portland Trail Blazers. So let's get back on a positive note to close. You know, in conclusion, is there anything you want to say to Blazers fans about your book? I mean, is there anything at all negative about the Blazers this season, or is it just all cupcakes and rainbows?
Well, I think the backup point guard position is still a bit of a concern. You know, that was an issue down the stretch last season with Bayless getting force-fed into that role. You know, the defensive schemes. You know, I think that there's still some potential to improve the way they defend the pick and roll. Not to go Dwight James on you. God bless you, Dwight. No. The coaching staff is going to be interesting to watch how that shakes out with major changes there. You know, most teams don't change three assistants in an off season. That's going to be a bit of an adjustment for Nate McMillan to get in the comfort zone with working with some guys he's never worked with before. And in the case of Bernie Bickerstaff, it's been many years since they were together. So I think that's going to be something worth watching during training camp. So, you know, I don't think that it's all sunshine and rose petals and whatever and things like that. You know, there are some issues there, but when you look at the potential to do really great things, that's also there.
Call it a podcast, KP. It was great to get back on the phone with you. I can't wait for this NBA season. It's shaping up to be an awesome one. Could be the last NBA season ever. I think the lockout is just going to shut down the entire league. So
Enjoy it.
let's save the last dance, shall we?
Let's go out on a high note.
All right, bud. We'll catch up with you after we've had some training camp stuff to digest. We'll look forward to Basketball Prospectus 2010-2011 in print. Relatively shortly. Can't wait for that. It's been really fun to edit KP. You know, I mentioned this on Twitter probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, but just one final plug. KP, in his first book to his second book, he took a Durant-style leap here. I mean, the quality of the writing's off the hook. And this guy is going to be the most improved player, and he was already Rookie of the Year. Everyone go out and buy that book. With that, I think I've done what I was supposed to do, right? I mean, you're going to pay me now.
That'll be in the mail. Go for that tomorrow.
Just put the check in the free PDF copy and send it over whenever you get a chance. I became more curious. Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEO's hurt, now here come big cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup.
for you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer. Come street.